Winter's coming. How's that book of yours coming along?
And I said, you know what? Don't procrastinate any longer. Get your butt out the door and come and sit and write.
NaNoWriMo, Stories from a Berlin Kitchen, and Why We Still Need a Women's Movement. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, The Women's Perspective. Women like to connect. They're communicators. And nothing has opened up the world to women with a drive to write than the blog. In just a few minutes, you can set up a page and soon you're talking with the rest of the world. Nora Ephron's last project was a film based on blogger Julie Powell's book about her attempt to make every recipe in Julia Child's classic French cookbook. Now Louisa Weiss, better known to bloggers as the Wednesday Chef, has a book out called My Berlin Kitchen, the story of her attempt to integrate her childhood in Berlin and in New York, as well as her connections to Italy. It is, of course, a love story, as well as a book with recipes. Louisa, so many people can come up with a million reasons not to do something. And the fact that Julie and Julia was already a blog that became a book that then became a movie, and the fact that you feel like you came late to the blogging game, it's really important for people to hear why you didn't let that discourage you.
Right. Well, when I started the blog, I really did think I was the last one to the blogging party. I figured there were, you know, a handful of food blogs who needed another one. But I really wanted to give it a try because I had all these recipes that I was drowning in and I wanted a writing practice. So I did it anyway. And what really was the most amazing thing that came out of it was finding my readers, because without my readers I would have never had the nerve or even the desire to write a book, I think. You know, I started the blog 7 years ago and I signed the book deal almost 3 years ago, so I'd really been blogging for a while before the book idea ever was born.
That is one of the strange things about the world of the blog. You are talking into what appears to be a vacuum. And the trick is, how do you reach people? Do you have any sense of how it happened for you?
Well, I think that some of it's just pretty regular blog stuff. You know, when you start a blog and you leave comments on other people's blogs, and then other bloggers and commenters or readers will follow you back, follow that link back to your blog. I got a little bit of publicity at the beginning, but I kept the blog anonymous for several years. I was kind of nervous about people knowing who was the person behind it, so I kept my identity hidden. And I think once I got over that and started being more open also with my personal life on the blog and how it related to the things that I was cooking, that my readers really started to grow, because I think that they felt some kind of kinship with me and were interested.
And that is another challenge for writers today. There is a hunger for memoir. People are very interested in it. But it is a big leap to say, okay, I'm going to let my hair down and talk about things that really are personal, that are important to me, and put yourself out there. What was that like for you?
For me, it was a very gradual process because I'd been blogging for several years just without divulging anything, really. And I felt like I'd built up that sense of trust with my readers so that when I did start finding it inevitable that little bits and pieces of my private life were making their way into the blog, they always responded just wonderfully with lots of emotion and respect and stuff. And so it was a relatively easy decision to just keep going on in that vein. I always have a pretty clear line in my head about what I'm willing to share and what I'm not, and that line never really wavered. So even in the book, when I talk a lot more candidly about things, I still always, you know exactly how far to go and no further.
The blog really has kind of upended the model of how you become a writer. If you are interested, you can be a writer today. You just start a blog. Is that what you would recommend for someone who wants to be a writer? Do you think the blog is the way to start that career?
Oh, that's a good question. Nowadays, it does seem like publishers really are looking for as much of a platform as an author can give So a blog is a great thing to have because it can prove, it's proof to the publisher that you know how to write, that you have an audience, that, you know, it's years in some cases of writing just right there for the reading. I don't necessarily feel that a writer without a blog who was able to sell a book needs to start a blog, but I think blogs are really good jumping off points. But besides that, I don't think anybody should start a blog with the hopes of it ultimately leading to a book deal. I think you should start a blog for its own merits. It's a wonderful way to find friends and readers and practice whatever it is that you're blogging about, whether it's photography or fashion or art or cooking. It's just a fun thing to do.
Another interesting thing I've noticed is certainly men do blog, but blogging is very popular with women. They really seem to enjoy that opportunity to communicate with women all over the world.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think it's because women are much more social creatures in a way. Women really feel the need to connect with other women in a much more profound way than men feel the need to connect with other men. And I think women also have a lot to say and a lot to share. And I think that's why blogging is such a female, I don't want to say occupation or hobby, but it's such a female thing to do. You know, women really like connecting and talking, and this is just a more pronounced way of doing that globally. I mean, I've got readers from all over the world. I read blogs from all over the world. We all seem to have similar, kindred spirit type things, no matter whether they're from Singapore, Australia, or New York. Yeah, I think women just like connecting with other women really, really deeply. And that's, blogs can allow that to happen. They're such intimate things.
And it strikes me, too, that in our mothers' and grandmothers' days, cooking was the way to communicate. You would get together and share recipes and share menus and learn to cook from each other. So you really kind of tied that all together, didn't you?
Yeah, I think I did. I think that's a really good point, actually. It's the worst case that you develop your creativity, and that's a wonderful thing in and of itself. And I feel like cream rises to the top. If you've got something good to share, other people will want to find it.
Louisa Weiss is the author of My Berlin Kitchen. Her blog is at thewednesdaychef.com. Ready to write yet? November is National Novel Writing Month, sometimes known as NaNoWriMo. All over the world, writers register at the NaNoWriMo website and solemnly vow they'll try to write a short novel in just 1 month. Last November, in a studio loft on Chicago's West Side, writers of all levels came together for write-ins, an effort to jumpstart each other to success, completing 50,000 words in 1 month. David Bernier reports.
It's early on a Monday night in a building along the L tracks on Chicago's Northwest Side. In a second floor loft here above a gym, people gather for what's being called a write-in.
Well, I'm writing a book that's somewhat true, but I'm kind of changing a few things around to make it more interesting, I guess.
This is Story Studio in Chicago, a writer's workshop. Hardwood floors, comfy couches, and overstuffed chairs. There's a distinct smell of coffee in the air, some pizza and chips on a table. It's busy here, but in a quiet sort of way. And in nearly every corner and tucked away spot, there are writers, like Donna, leaning into their laptops.
I just needed to get out of the house to write. And I said, you know what, don't procrastinate any longer. Get your butt out the door and come and sit and write.
Donna works in the mental health industry, but she doesn't want to tell anyone exactly where. It would give away the true stories that helped shape her manuscript, a story she describes as the hell of dating at the office.
Everyone always told us, don't date anyone you work with. And it's just about how I've stuck to that, waited about 2 years before I wound up giving in, and then all the hell that has pursued from doing that, and why I probably should never have done that in the first place.
So that's what the story is about?
Yeah. And sex. Not necessarily love and sex.
The stories being shaped here are as diverse as the people. There's a college student writing a fantasy about how goblins created the Great Depression, a young mother with a story of war-torn love, a college teacher named Jess writing about one very troubled student.
He seemed very angry about the class and about me and was very hostile. And you come here every day and hassle me, so what the hell, you know? And so in the end, I'm killing myself off.
This write-in is part of what is affectionately called NaNoWriMo around here, or just NaNo for short.
Being in the same physical space with other people who have kind of the same goals as you, I think, is a real motivator.
National Novel Writing Month was started in 1999, a group of 21 writers in San Francisco. They wanted to challenge each other to write 50,000 words in 1 month, meaningful, literary words. Since then, an organization was formed, and more than 200,000 people have officially taken part in NaNoWriMo. Where are you?
3,000 words.
It's about 20,000.
Only a few hundred. I mean, I'm very behind. Yeah.
This write-in is one of a few here in November at Story Studio. As many as 60 different stories are expected to come out of the work that's done here. About halfway through the five-hour write-in, Ian walks in and looks for a place to plug in his laptop.
A year ago, tried to do NaNoWriMo and then failed, and I thought maybe if I come to one of these things, I'll like work my way into it, because the best way to get through writing is to kind of lock the keys in the trunk and then work your way out from there.
Most publishers would consider 50,000 words a shortish novel, but still a novel, and that's the goal. Get in those 50,000 words and then look for a chance to get the story out there somewhere. Success from NaNoWriMo has been documented. The first draft of the bestseller Water for Elephants was written during Novel Writing Month. Down a narrow hallway and into a room with desks fashioned into a large square shape, things are a little more formal, more like a classroom. And inside are four women. One is Jennifer, a published author of a romance novel who is working on another.
It's set in the Regency era, and it is about Lady Charlotte, who has been jilted by her fiancé and has developed a plan to fake an engagement to win him back.
Next to her is Rachel, who says her story is based on a dating experiment she conducted.
I decided to meet 50 guys in a year. Guys that I would actually consider dating, not just a random guy.
50, though?
50. In one fantastic story.
Although some here are just beginning their word journey, logging in maybe 300 words, Rachel, writing under a pen name, Reed Stone, is already kicking literary butt.
55-4.
You're over the limit?
I am. I quit my job, started organizing, and started writing.
And although Rachel has written more than she needs to for NaNoWriMo, she figures she's going to try to finish her story before the end of the month.
I looked. I didn't find Reed Stone's novel anywhere, though I did find a book about 51 dates in 50 weeks. Ah, the frustration of finding out somebody else had your idea. Want to join in? Check out NaNoWriMo.org. Coming up, why the women's movement is still essential. Plus, the woman who inspired Susan B. Anthony. If you missed part of this show or want to hear it again, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1216. The shooting of 14-year-old Malala Yousafzai by the Taliban and the Taliban's promise that they would continue to target the young girl they call a spy for the West has focused world attention on Pakistan. Malala's crime? She spoke out in favor of education for girls. Carla Goldstein, director of the Omega Women's Leadership Center, has some thoughts on why today's turbulence needs the women's movement.
In any discussion about the relevance of the women's movement, profound outrage has its place. Like when a young girl is shot for having the courage to speak out for girls' education. Or an elected official talks about legitimate rape. Or a young pregnant woman dies of aggressive cancer because the state protects her fetus instead of her. Or a public official is censored for saying the word vagina in a public policy debate. The supply of the outrageous is vast enough to keep us in a state of perma-scream, but that's not sustainable. To make the kinds of changes we dream of, our outrage has to be paired with everyday efforts to create a fundamental shift in human consciousness from us against them to we are all in this together. While it seems our human conflicts are so deep and complex that we might not ever find a way out, there has been a persistent idea across time, culture, religion, and ideology that we can live as a more unified, loving, and connected human family. That's why we still need a women's movement, and one that is actively joined by men. We need a women's movement because the fracture between women and men is cornerstone to so much of the world's pain and trauma. Girls and women still suffer disproportionately from gender-based violence, discrimination, and lack of access to basic human rights. And we need a women's movement because boys and men still suffer immeasurably from sexism. Narrow definitions of masculinity force boys and men to live within a narrow band of human experience, often being shut off from the feminine in themselves and taught to be hostile to the feminine in girls and women. And we still need a women's movement because the movement's vision of change goes well beyond the important notion of creating gender equality. It is about figuring out how we can take care of everybody and of the earth that sustains all life. Making this kind of deep and lasting change is no small order. It requires massive systems change, including re-engineering of our economies, politics, and religious institutions. And it requires a steely commitment by individuals to be the change and re-engineer our own personal habits, motivations, and the way we live together. This vision is often dismissed as naive and not possible because it is argued that an us-against-them world is preordained by nature or God or both. Yet science reveals that cooperation is the dominant thriving survival mechanism, and most religions and spiritual doctrines are based on a unity principle. In every corner of the world, women are creating new pathways of human progress, building bridges across some of the deepest fractures in the human experience. Women like Edith Schlaffer, founder of Women Without Borders, is working with mothers to end extremist violence. And Hyun Kyung Chung, a theologian, is helping to create a peace movement between North and South Korean women. And here in the U.S., Ajahn Poo, director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance, is building a comprehensive campaign to change how society treats care. And the women's movement is not and has never been only for women. In a wonderful new national initiative, A Call to Men, founded by Tony Porter, boys and men are taking responsibility for changing cultural norms. The organization is working with a wide range of people, from the United Nations to the NFL, to create a new definition of manhood that helps build a world that is safe for everybody. One of the great strengths of the women's movement has been its central chord of optimism, that the world can be different, that change can happen, and that women can and will take responsibility for bringing that change into being. Instead of debating whether there is still a need for a women's movement, we should all be asking ourselves what role we will play in healing the deep fractures that exist between us and to help realize the enduring promise of an all-of-us world. The need for a women's movement is as clear as ever.
Carla Goldstein is director of the Omega Women's Leadership Center in Rhinebeck, New York. Find out more at eomega.org. When you think of the original abolitionists and suffragettes, do you think of the name Lucy Stone? Gilles Malkin has the story of a woman who inspired the early suffragettes.
You may have heard of the great suffragette, Susan B. Anthony. But did she perhaps have a mentor, an idol, a model after which she continued work already begun? Yes, indeed she did, and that person's name was Lucy Stone. Stone was born in 1818 to farming parents. Her father was a drinker and a tyrant, and Lucy watched as her mother was forced to finagle ways behind his back to get money for the children's clothes and other bare necessities. Lucy understood the goodness behind the sentiments in the Bible and she couldn't help but notice that this goodness was inconsistent with what she heard read aloud from it, depicting women as inferior and subservient. She decided early on that she would someday read the Bible in Latin in order to see for herself if the English version hadn't conveniently suffered somewhat in the translation. She eventually carried that through and confirmed her suspicions. She worked as a teacher and became familiar with the speeches by the Grimke sisters, who were staunch, inspired abolitionists of the day, and who were outraging men with their gall to speak publicly, mostly to church groups, against slavery, which at the time was an essential element of the success in economics both in the North and the South. The Grimkes hit a nerve by comparing women's situation to that of slaves, and this inspired Stone to follow suit. Lucy Stone was graduated from Oberlin College in 1847 with high honors, becoming the first woman in Massachusetts to receive a college degree, and she was asked to write the commencement speech. She agreed, but she wasn't allowed to present it. A man would do it in her place. She then declined. Later that year, she received her first paid lecturing employment by the abolitionist group, the American Anti-Slavery Society, to speak against slavery for $6 a week. The group leaders came to object to her including women's rights in her lectures, but she insisted. They burned her posters, sprinkled pepper in the audience, and threw eggs and Bibles at her. In 1850, she gave the final speech at the National Women's Rights Convention in Worcester, Mass., and spoke so eloquently and convincingly that Horace Greeley, founder and editor of the New York Tribune, gave her a rave review, spreading her words and bringing new inspiration to the cause. She soon began to include the subject of temperance in her work, this causing added force to her impetus of working to improve society. She observed, "If a woman earned a dollar by scrubbing, her husband had a right to take the dollar and go get drunk with it and beat her afterwards." In 1855, Lucy Stone married Henry Blackwell. They vowed to renounce all aspects of marriage which gave any advantage or authority regarding control of property and children to the husband. The statement was subsequently published and mocked in papers all over the country. In 1858, Lucy Stone refused to pay property taxes, since she was not allowed to vote, claiming that it constituted taxation without representation. Police were sent to her home to hold a furniture auction that quickly provided the tax payment, and her neighbors returned her furniture to her. In 1879, when the right to vote for members of school boards was first granted to women in Massachusetts, Lucy Stone refused, because she would have been obliged to register using her husband's last name, which she refused to do. A formidable orator from the force of her own convictions, she lectured and worked tirelessly to promote the idea of legal equality for women. She taught Carrie Chapman Catt all about political organizing and motivated countless other champions of women's rights, such as Lucretia Mott, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and Susan B. Anthony, and later Alice Paul and Eleanor Roosevelt. Lucy Stone died in 1893, well before the passage of the 20th Amendment, which guaranteed women's right to vote. Thank you for listening. For 51% and Women in History, I'm Gilles Malkin.
Gilles Malkin is a writer and musician. He lives in New York's Catskills. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.